I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales. Well, hello, hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm good. I'm not going to do a British accent.
That might be better, because I thought about doing this the old time, but I don't think I can keep it up. So I'm actually glad to be here this week, because after last episode and the research we did, I thought my brain was going to be fried. But
yeah,
we made it through, and we made it through without much brain damage. So we're here. We're back. We're going to try to give it our best.
What he doesn't tell you is that every time I say the word steamboat, he wets himself and forgets who he is for a few minutes.
Yeah, at least the wetting myself is right. I mean, but anyway, glad to be back this week. And we wanted to let y'all know that we are working on some swag for you guys, you know, because we really appreciate all the love that you've shown us and spreading us to everybody and telling everybody about us. The growth is just amazing. So we want to try to give back to y'all, and we're looking at doing t-shirts and stickers and maybe even some little lapel pin things that you can put on your bag or your hat or your lapel. If you have lapels now.
Yeah. Pretty cool stuff.
Yeah.
You'd be amazed at what you can get your logo put on.
Yeah.
I mean, besides like ink pens and coffee cups, I mean,
there's a few things we could get it put on that I'm not going to do that.
I know. Some more adult things.
Yes. So rest assured, we won't have any Graveyard Tales versions of any of those.
Well, so, you know, not on the main site.
Right. So. We may have them here in the graveyard, but you know, I'm going to give me a pair of Graveyard Tales boxers and just... It says graveyard on one cheek and tails on the other.
That's actually better than what I thought you were going to say.
I cleaned it up. This is a family show, Matt.
I know. Just forward my mail to the gutter, because that's where my mind lives.
That's all right. That's all right. It could be worse. But before we get into the meat and potatoes of tonight's episode, let's take a quick break and let's hear from two pods, BS Pod and In Poor Taste.
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm the believer.
I'm Cody. I'm the skeptic.
And together we are BSP, the Idiot Syncrasy Files.
The podcast where two idiots discuss weird phenomena. This week we're talking about ghosts.
I believe in ghosts.
Why?
There's too much weird stuff in the world for it to be coincidental.
See, I don't, because ghosts are souls, and shirts, pants, and jockstraps do not have souls. These ghosts should be naked.
My jockstrap has a soul.
Moving on. Join us every week where we talk about cool phenomena ranging from
skinwalkers
to
simulacra.
There you go. Bye. Find us on Google Play, iTunes, and all those other podcasting places, or visit us at www.bspodphx.com.
I'm Don Wrinkle, and everybody's got a podcast. And if you're gonna listen to one, In Poor Taste is the way to go, because it's very greasy.
This is Bill Lawyerson to tell you that In Poor Taste is the podcast you should listen to if you want to get sued.
I'm Big Jim, here to say if you listen to In Poor Taste, I guess we'll give you a Christmas handy.
It's In Poor Taste. It's definitely not a comedy podcast.
And it's definitely not educational.
And it's definitely Australian.
Stop asking!
Hello, I'm a Giorgio Casadoro, and this is my brother.
Fativa.
Come on down, In Poor Taste, we take you in back and polish your jewels.
That's us.
South Hills, Pittsburgh.
Born and raised.
Listen to In Poor Taste on the Podsburg Network, www.podsburg.com/InPoorTaste for all of your edutainmentional podcast needs.
If you guys it, they will pod.
All right, everybody, we're back. And what we wanted to do, we've got so many listeners sending in stories, and that's great. That's what we want. You know, we want to hear from you guys and get your thoughts and your opinions and any of your personal experiences. So what we're going to do tonight is I've got one story that was in the news that I want to talk about. And then I've got two stories from listeners that we'll get into and we'll read those out. And if it's not your story this week, don't feel bad. We'll get to it because we're going to try to edge these in as we go along in different episodes. So just keep listening. And if you've sent one in, we'll get yours in eventually.
Yeah, eventually.
But yeah, never know, but it'll be in there.
Nah, we'll get it.
We just can't.
We appreciate you sending them.
Oh yeah. And we appreciate y'all letting us share them on the show. You know, it would be great to get them and just get to read them, but it's even better when we get to share them to all of the graveyard.
Right.
So the first story I've got is one from the news, and a lot of y'all may have heard about it, but it's the CDC man that went missing. Now, his name is Timothy Cunningham, and he's an epidemiologist at the CDC. Now, he left authorities, according to this news report, he left authorities scavenging for clues after he left work early on February 12th and never returned. Cunningham had called his sister that morning and talked to her about his supervisor passing him up for promotion. So he was reportedly bummed, and she said he didn't sound like himself on that phone call. He just sounded weird because he was disappointed and all that. And he ended up going missing and has not been found since. Now, the Atlanta Police Department says this is an extremely unusual set of circumstances. We deal with missing person cases fairly regularly here. The circumstances on this one, just beyond the fact that he's a CDC employee, but as a general person, are unusual. Authorities believe Cunningham made it to his home in Atlanta, but nothing else indicates where he may be now. In the CDC employee's house, nothing seemed unusual, and the residence seemed secured aside from two windows being open. They go on to say the most unusual fact in this case is that every single belonging that we are aware of was located in the residence. His keys, cell phone, credit cards, debit cards, wallet, all of his identification and passports, anything you can think of, and we've been able to locate it. Cunningham also called out of work sick the 2 days before the last time he was seen. Now, Chris Torrey, a neighbor of Cunningham's, told the news station that Cunningham made an unusual request a few days before he disappeared. He said he and his wife and Cunningham had swapped numbers over the weekend, and Cunningham called him over from across the yard the day before he disappeared to ask that his wife take his number out of his phone. And the police department says there's no evidence of foul play, but all of the neighbors and everything, they have gone and they've done they've created a search party and they've canvassed all the houses in the area. Any of the houses that are boarded up, they've looked in all of those. They've gone down all the trails, the walking trails in the area. They can't find him. He has not spent any money since that day, but he left sick, is what he told his supervisor, and then just disappeared. His, along with all of his belongings, they found his dog, Mr. Bojangles. I like that name. reminds me of a Simpsons episode. Sorry. But Mr. Bojangles was left at home for 2 days until his family found him with no care. His family came down on the 14th of February, and he went missing on the 12th. And nobody's seen him since. So the reason I wanted to bring this up is because, to me, this is the start of a zombie apocalypse movie. You know, a CDC official who, he worked on the Zika virus and the Ebola virus and all that. He was one of the ones in the team that helped to control those outbreaks. Then he leaves work sick one day and just disappears. That's patient zero, guys. That's how it starts.
Yeah, it's like, isn't this the beginning of Outbreak? Isn't that how it goes?
Something like that. So it's weird to me. It's worried me a little bit, but hopefully they find him and nothing is too weird and we don't have some kind of weird viral outbreak now that he got into while he's working at the CDC, and then now he's escaped and it's on the loose, you know?
Yeah. Have you ever thought about that? How hard it would be to just disappear?
I have.
Go completely just off the map, just vanish.
Go rogue and off grid.
I mean, because you got to think, if they've got his debit cards and his credit cards, they've checked his bank accounts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they obviously he didn't go drain them.
Right.
You know, to think that he's got cash.
Right.
That would have been a clue that he took off.
Right.
But think about it. No money, no ID.
Mm-hmm.
Where the hell are you going to go?
Right.
I mean, you know, you got to have some of that stuff, you know, minimum to get far enough away where people wouldn't know who you are. And this guy's face has been all over national news.
Right. If you're going to not just leave the country, but if you're going to leave the city, you need an ID. If you're driving, you need your ID in case you get pulled over. Because if not, then, hey, guess what? You're going to jail. You'll turn up there.
Yeah.
They'll have you there. I think even to buy bus tickets, you need an ID to buy bus tickets. I may be wrong, but, you know.
Even if you don't, you need money.
Right. Right. So.
And I would imagine I don't know that I've ever actually bought a bus ticket.
Right.
So I don't know if you'd need an ID, but it seems like in today's climate, you would.
You probably would, yeah, to get on mass transit.
I don't know. It seems really, really strange that, you know, all this belongings are left behind and he's just gone.
Yeah. The police say they don't think foul play is involved.
No foul play.
Yeah, but okay, if it's not foul play and it's not some weird outbreak of disease that he's got, then what in the crap is it?
Right.
You know, it's got to be one of those two. I mean, unless he just decided, hey, I'm done, and he went and handled something, you know, but
true.
I mean, that
they just hadn't found him yet.
Right. And that would be the third option there. I'm leaning more toward the outbreak of some weird disease. I don't want to be, but that's the way my mind goes, you know.
That's the most logical.
Right, right.
It's Occam's razor, right?
Exactly, exactly. So if y'all have thoughts on it, let us know. What do y'all think's going on with that CDC guy?
If zombie apocalypse is your answer for something, you may need to rethink your theory.
No, zombie apocalypse is my theory for everything. You know, I mean, have you seen my house? We're prepared for the zombie apocalypse here.
Oh,
brother.
Yeah. Bring them on.
Yep.
I'm coming here.
All right. So let's get into our first listener story. And This is from a listener named Kelly. She said, 7 years ago or so, I worked at a doggy daycare. The place was in an old building that had been many things, but most notably, it had at one time been a butcher shop. In fact, there were still racks installed in the ceiling where they used to move the butchered cows around, and the main playroom for the dogs had been where they hung them to drain the blood. The building had always felt creepy to me, but I don't think it was necessarily related to the butcher shop. It was just a dark, spider-filled, generally gross and echoey building. The other three employees and I had experienced many things: disembodied female voices, music, female laughter, footsteps, doors opening and closing, objects being moved, and the dogs would often react. To be fair, there was a school nearby, and you could hear the kids on the playground yelling and laughing, but the music sounded like an Old West Saloon-type piano, and the laughter and voices were decidedly adult and didn't have the higher-pitched tones of a child. I don't think the things we heard came from the school. There was a definite difference. We started keeping track in a spiral-bound notebook of the things we heard, making sure to note times and environmental conditions, like how many dogs were present and if the school was in session. And in the space of just a few months, we filled it, front to back. A couple of experiences that really stuck out to me were these. It was the end of the day, I had two dogs left, and I was doing my cleaning up while waiting for their owner. The building had a storefront, then a small wooden ramp that led to a small playroom where these two dogs were, then a set of swinging doors with a larger room that led to the yard. I was sweeping on the other side of the swinging doors when I heard a woman's voice say, "You're such a good boy," very clearly in a sing-songy voice like you would use to talk to a dog or a child. So I went into the small playroom thinking the owner was here, but no one was there. The dogs were reacting, eyes trained toward the storefront, which was clearly visible from the playroom, separated by a half door, and ears perked. The second experience happened at noon on a day that I didn't have any dogs. The rule was, if no one showed by noon, we could close up early. So when noon came around, I shut off all the lights and went back past the swinging doors to shut the large garage door that led to the yard. As I was walking through the darkened building, there were no windows and it was a cinder block building, I started feeling uneasy. Nothing too bad, just a little jittery. I shut the garage door and locked it and spun around to head back to the front. I made it about 5 steps when the dark seemed to get heavier. I can't explain it other than to say it was all of a sudden more than just natural dark with the lights turned off. It felt like it had substance. The hairs raised on the back of my neck, and I knew that if I turned around, if I looked behind me, I was going to see something I didn't want to see. So I started walking faster. I made it another 10 steps or so to the swinging doors when a voice whispered my name in my right ear, so close that the tiny hairs that always fall out of my ponytail moved. So I ran. I got the hell out of there as fast as I could. Like I said, we'd always experienced a bit of weirdness at the daycare, but it was always female and always seemed friendly. This was the first and thankfully only time that I had felt in danger. I actually ended up leaving the job shortly after, unrelated to the ghost incident, and the place burned down a few months after that. So, haunted doggy daycare. I wouldn't work there.
It's not really a place you expect to run into specters or of any type.
So. No. But what I did find kind of fascinating about that one is that the dogs were reacting to it.
Yeah.
You know, and that whatever it was actually interacting with the dogs, you know, talking to the dogs, and they were reacting with it. So that was kind of fascinating to me. But we got a second story here, and this one comes from Rebecca. And this one, after we read it, we want to know y'all's opinion on it because she has a question for you guys. This is the My Buddy Doll incident.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I remember the My Buddy Doll. My brother had one of those. And that was, y'all know my feelings about dolls. And that was a weird doll to have around.
Yeah, isn't it? My buddy.
Mm-hmm.
My buddy.
My buddy and me. Yeah, buddy. All right.
I literally just, why that stuck in my head all these years, I have no idea.
Because you're a goober, that's why.
I can't remember stuff that I really need to remember, but I can recall that.
Yeah, you can remember jingles from the 80s.
I should be able to run through my brain and hit the delete button on some of that crap that's just blocking up.
Yeah,
stuff.
You should, because like I've said before, you know, there's a finite amount of space up there.
Yeah.
And if I learn too much on like one of these episodes that we're doing, I forget how to get home and how to tie my shoe for a while until I can get rid of it.
Steamboat.
So she says, in the winter of 1985, I was pregnant with my fourth child, who was due on December 21st. On TV, they had been advertising a doll called My Buddy. This was a doll they had made for boys to play with, as there was another one called Kid Sister for the girls. Well, my other two boys wanted the My Buddy doll for Christmas and asked Santa for them, thinking this would be a good idea with the new baby coming. Santa, well, I got my sons, and I'll call them J and Z, not one word, but two separate words, not Jay-Z. She's not Jay-Z's mom.
Jay-Z and the My Buddy doll.
Yeah.
Boy, this story's getting better.
It is, man. Now, we'll call them J and Z just for anonymity's sake. So Jay was 5 and Z was 3. And she decided to get each one of them one for Christmas. When Christmas came, they were thrilled to have the doll they had wanted. Their new baby brother arrived January 1st, 1986. In February of 1986, I was putting the boys to bed and was giving them what they wanted to sleep with. The boys were in bunk beds, and as I started to hand them the My Buddy dolls, Jay had a look of terror on his face and held up his hand and shaking his head no to stop me from giving him the doll. I asked him if he wanted the doll to sleep with, and he replied, no, at night it transforms into a monster and tries to kill us. I tried to hand Z his doll too, and he too shook his head no. I thought I would see what their reaction would be when I told them if they didn't want the dolls, I would give them away, and both boys did not care. This was very unusual since they had both so wanted the dolls for Christmas, and now this reaction? I was not sure what to think. I knew that there had never been anything on TV that the boys could have seen of a doll turning into a monster or anything. So I put the dolls in the closet. After I put the dolls up, the boys never had any more problems with them. The dolls remained in the closet until around 1989. At this time, my friend Hope called me and told me I had to watch a movie that was called Child's Play. Y'all remember the movie Child's Play? She would not tell me anything of the movie, but said I needed to watch it. When the movie was being shown, I turned it on, and me and the kids sat down to watch it. Yes, although my kids were young, we would watch scary movies together, and if they had any questions, I would answer them honestly. They never had nightmares either. Well, the movie came on, and we watched, and when they showed the Chucky doll, Jay got up, went into his bedroom, to the closet, and came back in the living room with the My Buddy doll going, Chucky, Chucky. I was floored, as the boys had not played with these dolls since they had been put in the closet in 1986. Their experience happened 2 years before the movie Child's Play had ever been released in the theaters in November of 88. After we watched the movie, I called my friend Hope to tell her what Jay had done with the doll and how much the two looked alike. Hope said she had a bad feeling about those dolls when she saw them in the store, but never said anything to me because she knew the boys wanted them so much. She says, yes, I still have the dolls, but they are packed away. The incident happened when we lived in Ohio, and now we live in California. And she said, she asked, after sending this story, she asked if anybody else in the graveyard had had an experience like that with one of the My Buddy dolls. And it's interesting, because that made me think too, is there anybody else who may have had an experience like that? You know, because they're creepy dolls. Who knows what could take possession of a doll like that? Because it was quite human-like.
Right.
So we ask all of y'all in the graveyard, have any of y'all had any weirdness happen around the My Buddy doll? If y'all have, or if y'all have any creepy stories about the My Buddy doll, post them in the Facebook group or tweet them to us, and we'll make sure that Rebecca sees them, and we may have some follow-up stories from her later. So now Matt is going to get into the actual topic of tonight's episode. So Matt is going to get into the Codex Gigas. Now, Matt, what is the Codex Gigas?
Okay. The Codex Gigas is a manuscript that dates back to around the 13th century. Nobody is 100% sure, but based on analysis of the book, they are pretty good about knowing this is about the time that it would have been written. But the Codex Gigas is a Bible, essentially. It's contains the Old and New Testament. It contains several other works. Two works from Josephus Flavius, Isidore of Seville's Etymologies. It has the standard textbook for teaching medicine in the Middle Ages, known as the Ars Medicina, which is the art of medicine. It has the 12th century Chronica Bohemorum, which is the chronicle of the Bohemians. And it's got a calendar. It also contains magic spells and instructions on exorcism. So a pretty unique collection of works. Here's what's cool about it. After lots and lots of investigation and research and examination of the materials and the ink and the cover and the style of writing, it's determined that the Codex Gigas was written by a single scribe. Now, this isn't an original work. Monks would rescribe, you know, the text of Holy Scripture to create new Bibles. I mean, there weren't printing presses around this time. So this was a painstaking task to sit down and begin to rewrite the entire Bible.
Right. They kind of used it as like an atonement for sins or for something like that. Yeah. They would rescribe the Bible just to, you know, I guess to kind of help abolish any sins that they had committed.
Right. So, but there were also trained scribes, calligraphers and illustrators, that this was their job at the monastery. This is what they did. So all of the major written works were reproduced by monks. So this particular monastery where the Codex Gigas was written is in what is what's modern day Czechoslovakia or the Czech Republic. See, I can't even say the right name for the modern day, the Czech Republic, you know, around the city of Prague. So at that time, this was Bohemia. So just a little bit of information about why the Codex Gigas is so unique. Number one, it's huge. It's an enormous book. And I'm not just talking about the material contained within. The size alone is remarkable. The book is 36 inches tall. That's 3 feet.
Yep.
3 feet tall. It's 20 inches wide. And it's 8.7 inches thick. And you thought that copy of War and Peace you never got through was big.
Right. You were complaining about the fiction that I read sometimes, the Cthulhu book and all that. You were complaining about that being
that's another thick book too.
Right.
Yeah. You could knock somebody out with it. It has 310 pages made from vellum, which I've seen. It came from donkeys or horses. I've seen both, but donkey seems to be the yeah. most often used. And I even found a thing where it said 160 different donkeys. I'm like, how can you tell that? But
DNA, maybe.
All these jackasses in this book.
And the one who wrote it.
That's right. It has originally it had 320 pages, but at some point the last 10 were cut out and, you know, weren't found. It weighs 165 pounds. So, you know, when you thought that that math book that you had to tote around in your backpack in college was bad, imagine dragging this thing around. You had to have a dolly or something.
It's almost as heavy as I am.
Yeah.
Like, literally.
So just going over that, just going over the idea of somebody creating a book that's this large and covers this much material, you know, that alone is remarkable,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's not even the most remarkable thing about this book. So it's called the Codex Gigas. Codex Gigas in Latin means, wait for it, big book.
Right.
So.
Or giant book.
The medieval people, they really knew how to name stuff. So they were great at
creative.
That. What is this? What are we going to call this big book? We'll call it the big book. But it's known by a better name as the Devil's Bible. And so it gets this name because of a enormous color illustration of the devil himself. And he is crouching. He is outlined by two columns, but is essentially boxed in the drawing. And on the opposite page is an illustration of the kingdom of heaven. And this is strange because depictions of the devil were not uncommon, but they were uncommon to be in a biblical work.
Right.
If they were included in a biblical work, they were usually very small, sometimes containing a face or a head of the devil, but nowhere did you ever see a full portrait of the devil, you know, taking up an entire page. So, you know, another strange thing, you know, about this book, it's been speculated as to why this was put in there, but it you know, like I said, it does give the Devil's Bible its name. But why would it be there? Why would this author have put an image of the devil in there? Which brings us to why this book is so fascinating. The legend of the Codex Gigas. The legend says that in this monastery in Bohemia, there was a monk who breached his monastic vows. He committed some sin, and it's written that the sin was so heinous that it had to be kept secret. And so the monastery's hierarchy met to determine the fate of this one monk who had broken his vow. Would he live or would he die? What would his penance be? How could he seek absolution for this sin? Well, the sentence was that he was to be put to death in a slow, agonizing manner. He was to be walled up alive.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. I mean, you just, what do? You just stand there, watch this guy start laying bricks down there by your feet, mm-hmm. going, yeah, this is going to suck.
Yep. And then you're just stuck in a tiny space until you starve to death.
That's right. You dehydrate.
Yep.
You know, begin to wither away. You're in the dark. You're going to go, you probably go crazy
probably
before you actually die. So a terrible way to die. So knowing this, this monk said, I've got to find a way out of this. I don't want to die, especially not this way. So what can I do to convince them to let me live? So he went to the other monks and he said, for my absolution, my penance will be to write a book unlike any other that contains the known history of the world and will honor this monastery. And I will do it all in one night. So the monks discussed it, thought it was impossible, but he was so impassioned that he could do this. They decided, we'll let him try. Either way, we're going to get a magnificent work that will honor this monastery and the monks within, or he's going to die anyway.
Right. They didn't have anything to lose.
Right. So as the story goes, he was left alone in his chambers and he began to write. And as he was writing, midnight approached and he knew he was going to run out of time, which means he was going to die. So in desperation, he cried out to Satan that he would offer his soul in return for the assistance in completing this manuscript and saving his life. And the devil heard it and came to him and completed the manuscript by the morning. And that's why the picture of the devil is included to, in a way, show gratitude for his involvement in completing the book. Now, that's a really cool story.
Mm-hmm.
But let's kind of dig into the details of this story as to what could be true, what could not be true, and what's still kind of left up in the air. So, according to a study done by National Geographic, in order for someone to do this, they looked into how quickly a quill could move across a piece of parchment. And they estimated that a human being writing with a quill on parchment could create a line in about 20 seconds. A column, you know, in about 10 minutes. And to complete an entire page, about an hour. So at that rate, just for the manuscript, working around the clock, it would have taken a human being about 5 years to complete this manuscript. That does not include the illustrations, which, as we mentioned, the portrait of the devil, the kingdom of heaven.
But there were a bunch of small
right
drawings in there.
This book is fully illuminated. And if you've ever seen an illuminated text, you may not know that's what it was called, but you've all seen one. When you open up the text, the beginning letters are very ornate and decorated, often seen in a framework with vines and filigree, and you know, there's a lot of character there and color. They really leap from the page. And this is done throughout the manuscript. So that's why I say it's fully illuminated. Sometimes these letters would take, you know, an hour or more to complete just that. And there's countless, you know, letters and illuminations throughout the entire book. And if one takes you an hour, like there's no way,
right.
There's no way this could have happened. So extrapolating it out, they estimate that with the illustrations, if a person worked around the clock, it would probably take about 10 years to complete. But that's somebody working around the clock, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which we know can't happen. So let's take out the time that they would have spent sleeping, the time that they would have spent eating, going to church, performing their other monthly duties. And we're looking at a time frame that lands somewhere between 20 to 30 years for one person to do this. So average out to 25 years, somebody took the time to sit down and start writing and illustrating and spent probably the majority of their life working on this one manuscript. And they've studied the handwriting, they've studied the ink, and all of that evidence leads to the fact that it was indeed one scribe. So this is how they can tell. The inks that were used at that time were very specific. They had two main types of ink that used two main ingredients. They were either metal based, or they used crushed insect nests to create the ink, and along with other ingredients to add, you know, color and to make it smooth. But those were the two main ingredients. And so those are the two things that researchers now can hunt for, you know, in the actual Codex Gigas. Right. And so it's obvious that insect ink was what was used throughout from beginning to end.
Right. And every scribe had their own kind of mixture,
right,
you know, that was specific to them. Because it's how they learned to make it, and that's what they would continue to use. So you wouldn't see one scribe switch up how he made an ink halfway through.
Right. And he's not going to switch up between metal ink and insect ink. I mean, most likely it was an either-or kind of thing, and we either did it this way or we did it this way because this is what was available to us in the area where we lived. So it makes sense that by looking at the ink that this was just one person or maybe two or three, but nothing changed. So it's written in calligraphy, which was, you know, not uncommon at that time. I mean, that's how people wrote, but it takes a long time,
mm-hmm,
you know, to write in calligraphy, and to get it straight and to correct where you make a mistake. You know, that's going to slow this process down. But they can tell that all of the letters from beginning to end are so alike that it had to be done by the same hand. So again, that leads some validity to the fact that they think that this is indeed just one single person. So the question is could this one person have done it all in one night? Probably not.
Probably not.
But go ahead.
Well, one thing I'm going to say, you were talking about the time that it took for him to do the writing and all that stuff. A lot of times what a scribe would have to do is rule the page. So he would have to, before he wrote it out, basically like you've got college ruled notebook paper, he would have to do that himself to each page. And they said it could take upwards, you know, an hour to 2 hours just to rule the page prior to writing, prior to, you know, anything else being done. So he could spend an hour to 2 hours just getting the page ready to write.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that is a painstaking process.
You've got to love what you're doing.
That's right. Or you've got to believe what you're doing is for the glory of a higher power.
Right.
And this is what you've dedicated your life to. And that's, again, why monks were the ones that did this kind of work. The book itself, just the outside of the book is very unique as well. It's contained in a wooden folder. It's covered with leather and it's ornamented with metal. And we've already talked about the weight of this thing. Now we're going to put together an even heavier cover, you know, for such a large work. So there was craftsmanship that had to go into the cover. Again, that takes time. That's not going to happen in a single night. So, you know, if it did, it definitely had supernatural involvement.
Right. It would have to.
Yeah. You know, but I think it's easy to say, you know, the legend is a great story. You know, probably didn't happen. But nonetheless, we still have this remarkable work from the 13th century.
Right.
To be able to put together something as vast as this, you know, in such a scale, you know, it's amazing.
We can thank the legend for bringing it to everybody's attention. Because
right.
without that legend, you know, you may not know. It would still exist and it would still be in a museum somewhere, but it wouldn't be as widely known
yeah.
without the legend of the devil wrote this book.
Yeah. And, you know, one theory that I read was very, very interesting because no other work has the descriptions and instructions and magic spells and all this, the exorcism items. There's no other biblical work that has that included in it. And one theory is that the scribe was writing a self-help book for himself.
Right.
That he felt like he was tormented, even possessed, and that by writing this, he was exercising his own demon, which is, you know, an interesting thought, you know, no way to really go back and, you know, check that out. But it is interesting that all of that information is included as well.
Right.
The one interesting thing is even with this legend, the book wasn't forbidden to read or to talk about by the Inquisition, and it was allowed to be studied, you know, by many scholars. They said the handwriting in the book hasn't been found in any other known work. So whoever did this, it looks like this was the only thing they ever did. They do believe that the person that did this was an amateur. And as I mentioned before, when Adam and I were talking about the monks and how this might be a penance for a sin, it might have been their job. There were trained scribes, trained calligraphers, trained illustrators. This was what they did. You know, they had excessive training in how to do this and how to make the letters look, how to make how to space it correctly, all that. Even though it's remarkable, you know, the illumination of the letters, the illustrations within, and just the length of the manuscript and the calligraphy involved, they can still tell that it's an amateur. It's someone that hasn't been trained. It's a very gifted amateur, but
right.
an amateur nonetheless.
Yeah, there were little idiosyncrasies in the text, in the forming of each letter that showed that he didn't have formal training and probably taught himself.
Yeah. And they believe that many of the aspect of the legends were born in truth. However, it's that large picture of Satan would have been so unique at the time that it's likely that the legend altered the truth so that the story could be told in a more interesting way. Anyone from the time who looked at this book and saw this portrait of Satan would get the impression that this was the focal point of this book, which explains why people would believe that the monk had made a pact with the devil. What many would have failed to see was that the page opposite this portrait, as I said before, has a picture of the kingdom of heaven. Now, a lot of people believe that this double spread was most likely a symbol of the battle between good and evil taking place on earth. And it wasn't anything sinister meant by the monk, but something that actually was glorifying heaven, you know, by showing its fight over evil.
And having the devil, like you were saying before, having the devil boxed in on the page is kind of more evidence toward that, because in a lot of old manuscripts, when there was a picture of the devil, they would show him a lot of times ruling in hell. So he would be surrounded by souls or demons, and this is the only known text to have the devil boxed in on a page, and coincidentally enough, it's across from the kingdom of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically, you know, the kingdom of heaven and the devil fighting, and they've got him boxed in and controlled.
And we've got some photos of the manuscript and some of the pages and this picture of the devil that we'll put up in the Facebook group when this episode drops, so that when you listen to it, you can kind of reference what we're talking about. It gives you an idea of the size of the book and how it's done and how ornate it is. And you can see this nice selfie of the devil. So.
Right. Right.
But, you know, sticking with this about the devil, there's just some interesting things about the picture itself. He's pictured half clothed and he's wearing royal ermine. And now ermine is a fur and it does symbolize royalty. And they believe that he's portrayed wearing this because he was known as the Prince of Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
So it further exemplifies that dark royalty. And that's why he's shown. He's otherwise nude, essentially. But he is walled up in the cell, just like Adam mentioned. And it also plays into the legend, the fact that he's walled up in this cell, and the story is that the monk was to be walled up in the cell. Using that the word inclusus, which for centuries people believed that word meant to be walled up, you know, to be closed up, walled up. In reality, it means hermit or recluse. So there's a good chance that this was indeed one monk's lifelong journey, and that he chose a life of solitude in order to do this,
right?
In order to pull this off.
And there is in the back of the book where the word inclusus is included.
Yeah.
It has a name and then it says inclusus after it. So it would be like if I were to sign something Adam inclusus, it would be Adam the recluse.
Yeah.
And that's not too far off from the truth, because I kind of am. I'm a podcaster. I'm a recluse. But that's how it was signed.
Yeah. And I did find one reference that called the scribe Herman the recluse.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only place I saw it. So I'm not sure if that was just a fictionalized thing or if that was just the writer of that idea.
Yeah. There wasn't a whole lot of information on the, you know, who they thought, because there's a lot of names in that book.
Right.
And they, you know, weren't entirely sure if that was him or not.
And Herman, can you imagine? I just met this monk named Herman.
Right.
It doesn't fit.
And it's a little too close to Hermit. So Herman the Hermit.
Yeah, that's right. Peter Noon wrote the Codex Gigas. Adam and I have cracked the code right here tonight on Graveyard Tales. but as we said, yeah, the identity of the person who wrote the Codex Gigas, it is unknown, and they don't have anything that specifically points to any individual, and without any other works that match the handwriting, they can't attribute it, you know, via another work that this particular scribe may have done. Of course, he spent 25 years writing this one. So, I mean,
wouldn't have time to do anything else.
Maybe he had a collection of short stories that he, you know, put out right before he died, or, you know, something one of the other monks published posthumously.
Yeah. stole his work.
It's like one of my favorite authors was Michael Crichton. He keeps coming out with books. He's been dead for years. I don't understand. You know, yeah. How do they
pseudonym.
Do
pseudonym?
Yeah. But let's talk about a little bit about how the Codex Gigas got to where it is today. In 1594, the Devil's Bible was brought to Prague from the Bromov Monastery, where it had been kept since the year 1420. King Rudolf II asked to borrow the Devil's Bible, and he promised the monks that he would return it when he was finished with it.
Yeah, see, I knew guys that would borrow stuff and say, I'll return that.
I was waiting.
I had a Nintendo 64 back in the day, and a buddy of mine said, hey, man, I'm going to go off to college. Can I borrow it for the semester and I'll bring it back? He still has the Nintendo 64. So, James, if you're listening, I would like my Nintendo 64 back. I realize how long it's been, but you still have my Nintendo 64.
So when you flip to the back of the Codex Gigas, there's a card back there, and King Rudolf II's name is the last name written on that card, and his fine is like $427 million.
Yeah, I don't think they're getting that.
Oh, man, you thought returning that, you know, copy of Lord of the Rings was going to set you back when library.
It still will.
Yeah, you ever dug around in your house and been like, oh, crap, this is a library book?
Yeah, I did that moving houses one time. I found a book from when I'd lived in Texas that I had borrowed from the library, and it somehow moved two or three houses with me, moved states away. So they're not getting it back. I still have it.
Adam has the information on where the Codex Gigas is now, and it's not directly in front of me, so I'm going to let him tell you.
All right. So it moved around. It changed hands a lot. Queen Christina of Sweden had a habit of stealing books from other nations as like war prizes, and she would use them to enhance her own country's library. So she had books from Poland, Germany, the Baltic states, Denmark, and a whole bunch of other things that were on her bookshelf. Now, after the book was snatched from Prague and shipped back to Sweden, the Codex Gigas was kept at the Royal Castle in Stockholm. Now, a fire tore through the castle in 1697, and the Codex Gigas at that time was thrown out of a window to prevent it from being engulfed in flames. Now, it got damaged by the four-story drop, but it did survive. There's a story that one person standing beneath the window was said to have been injured in the process, but they think that may have just been a tall tale. But the Codex Gigas, after that, was rebound in 1819, and those damaged leaves were repaired, and the restored manuscript is now currently on view at the National Library of Sweden in Stockholm as a part of the library's treasures exhibit.
Yeah, so. And it's so big that they had to build a specific podium for it because it's so heavy, 165 pounds. Remember, they threw this out of a window.
Right. Can you imagine standing under that?
Yeah, that's like throwing a man out the window.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that's a lot. But even to open it and to turn the pages and to allow it to fold open like you would a large book, it has to be on this specific stand.
Mm-hmm.
Because the weight of it, just you couldn't do it otherwise.
Right.
You know, you couldn't even get it open and flip through it.
And on this stand, they have it displayed with the page that everybody wants to see. So when you go to see it, it's open to the portrait of the devil and the picture of the kingdom of heaven. And one thing we didn't talk about, I don't know if, Matt, you have it in your notes, and if I might be jumping ahead here a little bit, but that page with the devil on it and the page across from it with heaven on there is dark.
And right. Yeah, that's right.
And a lot of believers use that to say, well, this shows the power of the devil because he's burning the pages. And it's actually been shown that vellum that they use is light sensitive, and it's kind of like photo paper. Mm-hmm. If you allow photo paper to get hot, or you expose it to bright light, it's going to change color. And that's what this vellum has done over the years, because where are you going to turn?
That's
every time
right.
you open the book, you're going to turn to those pictures. And everywhere it's displayed with those pictures open. So the lights, the fluorescent lights, the sunlight, everything is just darkening these pages, where all the rest of them are the normal vellum color. And so that's kind of been debunked, even though people still try to say that that's yeah. proof that the devil reigns within this book.
Right. And it's covered with it has a custom made shroud that covers it to protect it from light and moisture and anything else that might damage mm-hmm. the text itself. Because I mean, it's old, and you know, vellum and those type of inks, you know, they are not really designed to withstand this length of time. So it had to be cared for. And especially in the modern era where, you know, pollution is so bad.
Right. It's not sunlight, it's fluorescent lights.
Right.
And fluorescent lights will do damage to text quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. So they take great steps in protecting this so that, you know, it'll be around for centuries and centuries for people to study. But my take on this is even if it's not true, even if this is legitimately the work of one individual for however long he had to work on it, it's outrageous.
Yeah, it's still an amazing work.
It's above and beyond anything of the time or anything since. You know, just the sheer magnitude of the text that it holds.
Right.
The size. I mean, I don't know why, if you're going to start writing a book, that you're going to say, I want this to be as big as possible.
Yeah. Let's make this 3 feet.
3 foot pages. You know, that's where I'm going to go. God, if that's your starting point, holy cow.
Right. Right. There is, if you're interested in reading any of it or seeing any of it, and you don't want to go to the museum and see it, there is a website that, if you search Codex Gigas, there is a website that has every single page on there that you can read online. And they do translate it to English for you, so you can read it. And if I can find it again, I'll post that link in the show notes so that you can click on that and go read up on it, besides looking at our Facebook group for the pictures that we'll post.
Yeah, because it is written in Latin. So,
right.
Which is very common.
My Latin is very poor.
Yeah.
Too,
I took 2 years of Latin in high school.
Yeah. I took Spanish.
I couldn't read this thing.
No, no. If it's not Spanish or English, I can't do it. Sorry. Lo siento.
But you know, an amazing work, and it is clouded in a lot of mystery and legend, which made it more attractive to Adam and I to at least touch on. And even though there's not as much information out there about this as other topics that we research, we thought this was really fun and really unique, and Amanda really wanted me to research this. So I did.
Yep.
It's such a unique thing, you know, that's a part of this world.
Yep.
Regardless of how it was produced, we know that it's old enough that it wasn't just manufactured off a printing press.
Right.
I mean, we know that. And, you know, everything about it is just, it's just amazing. And, you know, even to the point that the legend went on that the book was cursed in some manner.
Mm-hmm.
It was moved from one monastery after some financial hardships. The original monastery, and it was moved to another monastery where it was put on display in a cemetery. And while it was there, these people just started noticing, hey, this a lot of bad stuff's happening to us. And so finally the high bishop said, send this book back to where it came from. We don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did, but the damage had already been done. And that monastery that housed the Codex Gigas in their cemetery, everybody there and around died from the bubonic plague. And that monastery still stands today empty with all the bones of these monks that died during the plague. And so the book, at least at the time, was attributed to bringing the plague,
right?
You know, to that area. Now, you know, modern researchers know that bubonic plague was everywhere.
Right.
You know, it tormented most of Europe, you know.
But at the time, you know, with limited knowledge of science and everything like that, it was, anything like that was blamed on something supernatural.
Yeah.
You know, a curse or whatever. And you've got something there that's got a giant picture of the devil in it. And what are you going to say? Well, this didn't happen until we got the devil's Bible here.
That's
so
right.
It has to be the fault of
so
the
devil's
Bible.
It's got to be this cursed devil's Bible.
Right. Which did not do anything but extend that myth and legend about the book.
Right. Right. So pretty cool topic. I really enjoyed getting into this and reading. There is a really good documentary done by National Geographic on this book. If what I researched has interest you, then go watch it. It's not very long. It's maybe about 45 minutes long. It'll fill in a few of the gaps that I may have left out, just, you know, for the sake of time. But it's a really interesting thing. And these experts, as they go through these pages and they investigate, you know, how could this have been done? Why would it have been done? Could it have been done by a single person? I think we pretty much determined it wasn't done in a single night.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's pretty fascinating.
It's called The Devil's Bible, and you can find it on Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah. So go look that up. But if anybody has ever looked into this or researched it, you know, get in touch with us. Put a post in our Facebook group, and you know, we'd like to know if you know something that we haven't covered, talking about it tonight.
Right. Or if you've been over there to see
it. Let us know. We're going to post these pictures so that everybody can kind of get an idea of what this thing looks like and see this portrait of the devil. I've seen it so many times. It kind of haunts me now.
Right.
Because it's, you know, when you see it, you're kind of like, yeah, okay.
Yeah. It's a creepy picture.
It's creepy. I kind of thought like it looked like a kindergartner's rendition of the devil.
Yeah, it's a different drawing than most of that time period.
Yeah, but it's still pretty creepy looking.
Right.
So
what we're going to do next week is going to be a little different. And if it goes well, if we like it, if you guys like it, then we may throw it in from time to time. What we're going to do is Matt and I are going to go off on our own, and we're each going to research a separate topic and not tell the other one what it's about. And then day of the show, then basically I'm going to teach Matt and you guys about what I researched, and Matt's going to teach me and you guys what he researched.
That's right.
And so it'll be a little bit different. It'll be kind of fun for the two of us, and hopefully y'all find it enjoyable too.
Yeah. Graveyard Tales 101.
There you go.
So that's going to be next week's episode.
Right.
So y'all can look forward to that. But coming up, and we posted about this in our Facebook group and on the Graveyard Tales Facebook page. So we are going to do a sequel to our Urban Legends episode, which has been one of our most popular,
right,
if not the most popular. And so we thought, this is going to be fun. So let's look into a few more urban legends, but we want your help. We're some needy dudes, man. We are all the time asking for y'all's help.
Yeah, no
Send
kidding,
us stories.
Right?
Give us ideas. We're not going to do anything but talk into the mic. You're going to do all the work. Now, if you know of an urban legend that is either one you've heard in the past, there's an urban legend from where you live, whatever it is, put it out there. We might pick yours and research it and present it on the show.
Right. We'll pick a few a piece like we did last time.
Yeah, just like we did last time, where, you know, Adam and I have got several different ones that we're going to research, and then we'll present them to you for your consumption.
Right.
But we're going to need your help. So send us those urban legends. We want to hear them. We want to have fun looking them up, and the scarier the better. You know, if you got one that just really makes your butthole pucker up when you tell it, mm-hmm. then that's the one we want to hear.
Yeah. So. We want the pucker factor high. Man, I almost screwed that up. Almost had to put a beep in there. But yeah, send it to us, email graveyardtalespodcast@gmail.com, or like Matt said, you know, hit us up on Facebook or Twitter or something like that.
Yeah.
So we hope this was an interesting topic for you guys, like it interested us, and we will see you guys back next week.